John Zombro, here with another episode, number 109 of the Lifetime Athlete Podcast. This is the show where we're all about achieving peak performance in sports, fitness, health, work, and life at any age. This is also the show where we use science and we use common sense. In fact, I like to say often that this is where science meets common sense. We always want to be true to science. And one of the things to know about good science is that its main goal is to be less wrong over time. We always want to be learning, growing, and sharing. Balancing health and performance. And talking about that, I don't want you to be a bubble boy or a bubble girl. I want you to go hard from time to time and know that you can test your durable human beast. It's made for that. Just do it intelligently. Today's show is brought to you by Lifetime Athlete Coaching. Whether you want to get more fit, get lean, ripped, or jacked, I can help you to do it. If you feel like you're a little beat up, you have chronic injuries, and you want to solve that problem and get back to training without trashing your joints, we can do that also. And if you're training for a sporting goal and you need custom, individualized programming and ongoing guidance, that's my wheelhouse. It's what I've done for almost four decades and what I love the most. I don't and never will know it all, but I keep studying and evolving and helping you to get results. Here's three thoughts on what we all know and what I know. First of all, number one, we don't know what we don't know. Number two, we only know, in actuality, that which we know right now, current knowledge. And at some point in the future, when we look back, we'll have been wrong somewhere. We're just not sure where yet. And it's very important to have those kinds of perspectives when we go through much of life. But when approaching these topics of athletics and fitness and health and nutrition, doing so with an open mind, a bit of skepticism, and as little bias as possible is essential. I always try to look through an ancestral lens that uses instinctive wisdom and the common sense that humans have evolved with for over 2 million years. And I respect the athlete in all of us, all of you and myself. Working with me in a coaching capacity is easy. Simply go to thelifetimeathlete.com, click on coaching, and explore all the information that's available there for the different types of services and relationships that I offer. And you also have numbers of pictures of clients and testimonials and additional information, podcasts and videos that can help you to see if this is the right fit for you and then how to get started doing it. So today's title has two topics, fueling and fighting. We're going to talk about fueling for athletes and fighting back against the Reaper. That would be the Grim Reaper. First, I'd like to give you some thoughts about fueling for your workouts or competitions. And of course, nutritionism is important in every aspect or capacity, but today we'll just keep it limited to pre and post session considerations. So this gets fairly simple. You can either enter into a training session in a fasted or fed state, or you can also use those strategies on the backside of a workout or a competition. So situations where you might want to train fasted, or at least give this some consideration, will be some of the things I'm going to mention next. First of all, let's talk about semantics. Some experts will say 24 hours is necessary before you're actually fasting. So a fast in and of itself doesn't begin unless you haven't eaten for 24 hours. That information is out there. All I'm saying is that going into a session with an empty stomach, maybe having not eaten for 3 to 6 hours, we're going to consider that to be training in the fasted state. It is excellent when you don't want GI discomfort or distress. It's actually my preference most of the time to just train in a fasted state. It particularly fits the way I go about my own training, and I just don't have to deal with anything like heartburn or burping or other issues that might be TMI. Training in a fasted state or having not eaten before a workout is really effective for a low intensity workout. It makes a lot of sense when you're doing low intensity exercise because your rate of glycogen depletion or using up the stored sugar, stored fuel that you have in your muscles and liver, isn't so rapid. So you really just don't need a lot of fuel when you're going easy, at least as long as it's not exceedingly long. And the other side of the coin, it's fine to train in a very high intensity manner in a fasted state if the workout is brief. So you generally have enough stores on board that you don't really need to look at exogenous, or in other words, putting in more fuel sources before the session. Training in a fasted state can increase your utilization of free fatty acids for fuel. And of course, that's fat burning, aka fat burning. And that's especially true in individuals whose metabolisms are metabolically adapted to burn more fat and are not excessively carbohydrate dependent. Some of that gets into the topic of metabolic flexibility, and I think I'll save that for another show. But just summing that up, you can train fasted probably much of the time, especially when you're going easy, or even if it's a tough session, not too lengthy. So how about when to train in the fed state? Well, I would say this. When you're doing a large volume of high intensity exercise, that's anaerobic exercise or glycolytic, we're burning up that glycogen because in order for us to produce enough ATP or energy to fuel our mojo, we can't do that with, let's say, oxygen and fat alone. We've got to tap into that stored nitrous a bit. And so sometimes we want to be fed for that if, we're doing enough of that or it really counts, let's say. Or anytime you just want to spare your muscle glycogen. So that's kind of an art form to doing that. But having a little bit of circulating blood glucose will actually be used as a preferential fuel before you start tapping into your glycogen. But here's the trick on that. Timing is critical. You can get a problem known as reactive hypoglycemia. Or in other words, if you eat a large carb bolus too far out from your exercise when that metabolism switches up, you can actually produce quite a bit of insulin and then wind up with low blood sugar as you start your session and not feel very good. And so you have to experiment with that. So I would say, mess around with maybe a small, mixed macro meal about 90 minutes out. That could be kind of the smoothie, the type of configuration. Or a commercial product, although I'm not such a big advocate of overconsumption of processed foods. A little bit's okay, just not too much. Look at a really small, primarily carbohydrate bolus immediately before your exercise session or during. And what that'll allow to happen is you won't really get that same blood glucose response, because once you start exercising, those GLUT4 transporters on your muscle cells will immediately start taking up the glucose. So they work as a disposal sink in many ways. And also, whenever muscle protein synthesis is your goal, let's say strength training, hypertrophy training, and you're going to be in the gym, you want to make the gains, brah. Well, having some extra circulating amino acids, research has supported that that's a fairly good thing. I mean, you can certainly train without that and get most of the results, but when you're really looking at those 1-3%, there's a good reason to say, oh, well, I'm going to make sure that I'm training in a fed state and my pre-workout meal does have some protein in it. Now, moving on to post-workout fasting. So after a light or brief session, however you want to define that, what that means to you, there's no real need to immediately stock up on calories and macros. The body's just fine not doing that. And so for a lot of people who are in a weight loss focus, or they're really just doing some maintenance or fitness work, you don't always have to be chasing a meal following a workout. You can just fast. Here's the real trick, though. It probably should be temporary, possibly only 1-2 hours following exercise, and particularly This will be true after a high intensity session. What that does, it tends to it creates a fight or flight or stress situation in the body, sympathetic nervous system, high intensity work. And so we have an elevation of testosterone and human growth hormone and some other hormones are getting shifted around. And hunger is actually temporarily blunted. It's very much a product of the adrenaline. And just using an ancestral example here, I like to look through that lens. This would be very consistent with the story I'm always talking about. You're sitting around the fire with your clan, and the saber tooth rolls in. So everybody scatters and sprints and makes it up the tree. Hopefully 100% of the group does that. That's a real, exciting, high-intensity moment. You're not hungry right after that. It takes a while for things to calm back down and get into the parasympathetic or rest and digest mode. And so that's really the mechanism why you don't always need to eat right after high-intensity workouts. Most people don't want to. And I suggest what others have proposed as the WHEN principle. So you should eat WHEN, and that's when hunger ensues naturally. Makes sense, makes common sense, if you will, here at the Lifetime Athlete. Okay, so the last thing I'm going to say about post-workout fasting is never starve yourself. Exercise is a stimulus. It's also a stressor, one that we manipulate, but nonetheless, it is that. So, again, light fitness, no big deal. But if you do hard training, especially in the athlete who's doing it regularly, you need to be careful not to create the stress of starvation on top of the stress of training. And so post-workout fasting would be used wisely in that context. Now, and the final thing here is post-workout refueling. So anytime you're thoroughly depleted, probably again makes sense to refuel the body. So there's some clauses to consider here. Research supports that there really is a small but valid window for protein intake post-exercise, and that's especially true for the branched-chain amino acids, with leucine being primary among them, also valine and isoleucine, but leucine, L-E-U-C-I-N-E, would be important for maximizing muscle protein synthesis to have that coming in post-workout fairly soon. And then we also look at the topic or the concept of glycogen resynthesis, or rebuilding those emergency sugar stores within our muscles and liver. This might actually be more necessary for repeat offenders. I say that kind of jokingly, but someone who's training bouts of high volume or high intensity are quite frequent, and you're really in a hard training phase. It does make sense to get those carbs in, in that post-workout window, again, supported by science. And this is a little bit more true for people who have very carbohydrate metabolism. So in other words, someone who's often termed a sugar burner and really doesn't have metabolic flexibility, not really efficient at using fat for fuel, they really don't have too many options where they just need to get the carbs back in so that they don't have a hypoglycemic crash. So that's a health thing that we can address, but just looking at it, it's like, hey, most athletes probably want to get something in if they worked out hard enough and are doing it frequent enough. And so really we're talking about carbohydrates and protein here. That's really what exercise depletes or demands, and so should make up the initial focus. Obviously, we want some healthy fats in the diet, but there's not an immediate need for them as much so as would be for carbs and protein. So summing this up, experimentation is the key. Only you know what works best for you. And so through trial and error, you can figure this out. And I certainly encourage you to explore it. Look at your energy levels, how you feel, how you're performing. Look at digestion. Your palate, what do you like? How are you executing your workouts? How do you recover from them? And what kind of adaptations are you getting? So this is just one area where we can, we can tweak how we train. We can, look at how we're recovering, but how we eat strategically does make quite a bit of sense. So that's most of what I wanted to say about fueling, at least for today. Now I get this opportunity, this fantastic opportunity to talk about, hey, let's fight against the Reaper. Let's fight back against the Grim Reaper. The Reaper is out there, He is coming for everyone. Eventually, he'll get all of us. But you have some say in how all this goes down. You can go out, for the most part, on your own terms. There are choices that we can make. We can choose to live a healthy, high-performing lifestyle and maintain wellness, fitness, athleticism over a potentially longer and certainly higher quality timeline. Or we can select less optimal patterns of living and actually exemplify what would be an accelerated path to dying. This is a choice. You can live into your 80s and 90s, kicking ass at relationships, joy, work, family, sports, maintaining your own functional independence and vitality. You can stay healthy until nearly the very end, and then go quickly in your sleep, or at least somewhat expediently. Or you could have your first stroke, heart attack, or organ failure in your 40s or 50s, get started on a series of surgeries and hospitalizations, and begin a daily regimen of double-digit pill intake. You might last for several decades, but they will inevitably involve decreased capacity, enjoyment, and participation in life, and probably an institution-based, protracted ending. The very same practices that lead to peak performance in our teens and 20s are the ones that shore us up and keep us going toward 100. The rules of biology are consistent amongst all humans. No one is immune to them. Humans are genetically programmed to be athletic. The high-performing beast just works better and it lasts longer in mind, body, and spirit. Many experts suggest that human organs are designed to last about 125 years. That may be a bit of a stretch for most of us modern humans, but 95 is certainly a reasonable target. And as wonderful as this modern life is, we may have to accept that our relatively chronic exposure to unnatural levels of stress, food, environmental toxins, and other challenges might shave off 30 or so years from the get-go. So that's where the 95 came from, as opposed to the 125. Not that I'm not optimistic. As I indicated initially, we are all going to expire. Let's not be delusional about that fact. Most thought leaders in wellness, medicine, and longevity are promoting the concept that humans die pretty much from the same thing. Heart attacks, strokes, cancer, organ failure, loss of resistance to pathogens and diseases. That's really what kills us, is what gets us in the end. It's just that healthy people die of these things much later in life, and usually more rapidly. The onset of the problems tends to be much later, and the outcome more rapid. Lifetime athletes are able to participate in and contribute to all the areas of life to the greatest degree. Most of the infirmities that I mentioned before are currently recognized as disorders of lifestyle and metabolism, at least when they occur too soon in life. Genetics were once thought to be static and unapproachable in terms of the hands of cards that we are dealt with respect to disease and death. However, the newest science has taken on a slightly different understanding. Genetics are powerful and they do matter, but lifestyle or epigenetics plays the dominant role in how specific genes are either expressed or suppressed. As some will say, genetics loads the gun, yes, but lifestyle fires it. This is where the lifetime athlete system comes into play. Establishing a foundation of lifelong health through simple practices in nutrition, sleep, movement, and other lifestyle factors removes obstacles from a great health span. And then applying the essential elements of peak performance, which are training, recovery, and mindset, allows the human beast, that's you and I, to get that final 20% in awesomeness. You can't really be your absolute best by just being healthy alone. I'm here to say that. You need to be athletic, at least to some degree and according to your own definition. Being a peak-performing athlete for life is representation of the human experience maximized. Crushing sports goals at any age, staying fit, and capable of doing whatever you want, like being able to pick up your grandkids or even take care of your home independently. These are the definitions of a lifetime athlete. A person who can keep the Reaper at bay for as long as possible. Someone who really is hard to kill. If you'd like to learn more about how to do all of these things, consider coming to the Hard to Kill workshop in Bozeman, Montana on February 29th. Or if that doesn't fit your schedule, reach out to me through thelifetimeathlete.com or on social media to inquire about how you can bring this masterclass to your organization or workplace. So that's all I've got for today, folks. Thanks so much for being with me. This is Coach Jay-Z signing off until next time from The Lifetime Athlete, where you can achieve peak performance at any age.